В России вступили в силу поправки к закону о государственном языке,
называемый закон о запрете мата, все-таки был принят. Он вступит в силу
нецензурную брань в СМИ, кинематографе, театрах и
литературе. Русских классиков Маяковский, Есенин, Пушкин, Лермонтов порой тоже грешили.
Это прямое ограничение свободы творчества.
Retweeting a Twitter tweet or liking a Facebook post that the Kremlin doesn't like can now land you in prison. And salty language in theater performances, films, and the media can now lead to stiff fines. The purported objective of the latter is to promote traditional values and preserve the, quote, purity of the Russian language. But few doubt that the real point of both is to tighten the Kremlin's control over discourse, and therefore over politics. Will it lead to an Orwellian nightmare? Or to a Kafkaesque theater of the absurd? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Dan.
And joining me in our studio in Pirin, Prague, is Mirhat Sharapjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. Welcome, Mirhat.
Hi, thank you.
Mark, let's get the ball rolling with you. We have two distinctive yet complementary trends here working simultaneously that are illustrated by these two pieces of legislation that came into force this week. On one hand, we've had this series of laws promoting traditional values, from the criminalization of blasphemy to the so-called gay propaganda law last year. And now we have this ban on foul language in film and theater that went into effect this week, following an earlier ban on profanity in the media. And we've also had, on the other hand, a steady stream of laws and regulations to rein in, control, and monitor online behavior. Bloggers with more than 3,000 followers must register with the authorities. Foreign internet companies must make their servers accessible to the Russian authorities. And now retweeting or reposting or even liking content that's deemed extremist can land you in jail for 5 years. So, I mean, what's next? Thought crime? Mark, where do you see this going?
Well, as ever with Russia, attempts to create a sort of Orwellian controls will inevitably lead to Kafkaesque theater of the absurd. And in some ways, we've already had that. I mean, there's the case of Boris Domakin, who got 6.5 years for justifying terrorism. But that was based on something he wrote, which was actually justifying the 1881 assassination of Tsar Alexander II. So already we're into sort of ludicrous territory. I mean, I think essentially there are three things that are happening here. One is clearly that there is an attempt to control, to stifle dissenting and critical voices. But on the other hand, you know, we must realize that Roskomnadzor, the controlling body, is not the thought police. The limits of what it can actually monitor are really quite extensive. So I think it's more an attempt to build more self-censorship into the system, that people are just worried about it and therefore don't say things. And also it allows the state to then target whoever it likes. It's another one of these laws, like in some ways we've seen with corruption and the elite, that it's more than just the state wants to know that when it wants to reach down and grab someone, it'll find something it can charge them with. So that's thing number one. Second point is, I mean, much of this is declaratory politics. It's about Putin presenting himself as the social conservative icon. It's about the state presenting itself as this mighty engine of repression. And it's about presenting Russia in the world as precisely an island or bastion of purity, being assailed by the degenerative cosmopolitanism on all sides. And so that, I think, leads to the third point I'd make, is that in many ways this is a symptom rather than necessarily a cause. It's a symptom of an increasingly paranoid, even xenophobic tendency within the Kremlin, a mindset that sees the outside world as a source of this moral contamination. And therefore, I mean, the risk of painting it in a little bit tightly too extreme terms, it's another step towards the North Koreanization of modern Russia.
A sign of weakness, then, would you say?
It is. I mean, it's a sign of weakness, of insecurity, and also, frankly, of astonishing stupidness and naivete, thinking that you can hold back these tides, thinking that you can ensure that you control your little slice of the internet. You know, the world has gone beyond that point.
Right. And then another thing I want to add before we go to Mercat is that Russians are virtual masters at getting around things like this. I mean, something as simple as the law against profanity. Now, this, again, is not against public profanity. It's against profanity in film and theater. But it seems to be trying to promote a kind of a deeper social prohibition against profanity. And Russians are the most creative and amazingly skilled swearers of any nation I've certainly ever come into contact with. But they're also skilled at something else: swearing while they're not swearing. And I want to play a little clip we produced here at RFRL this week to illustrate this. And speakers of the Russian language will appreciate this, I think.
Ёлки-палки.
Ёшкин кот.
Ёкаламане.
Ёпересете.
Ядрёна-матрёна.
Ну ёж твою медь. Ядрить твою вдышло.
Японский бог.
Мать твою за ногу.
Ёханый бабай.
Японский городовой.
Ёлки зелёные.
Япона-мать.
Ну кипит твоё молоко.
Ё-моё.
Ёксель-моксель. Ядри твою мать.
Ёшкин корень.
Миклуха твою маклай.
Ёкани бабай.
Ну, ядрить твою в метель.
Туды ее в качель.
Ядрить твою в корень.
Япона мать.
Ядрить твою в разгон.
Моб твою ять.
И биться сердце перестало.
Ну, ё...
I cannot listen to that without cracking up. Every time I listen to it, I crack up. Mercat, I believe your voice is in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to, since this is a family podcast, I'm not going to say the phrase in Russian that those very decent expressions were euphemisms for. But Mercat, this points to something I wanted to get at. You spent a good chunk of your life in the Soviet Union, and you ran in oppositionist dissident circles and paid for it. In those days, people like you always found a way around the state's attempts to regulate how they thought, what they read, what they said, whom they associated with. Now, there was no internet in those days when you were growing up in the Soviet Union in the 70s and 80s. But the principle's the same. Do you see history repeating itself here? And what is what's the digital equivalent of the Soviet kitchen? What's the digital equivalent of samizdat?
Oh, first of all, in our kitchens in the Soviet time, we didn't have Wi-Fi. I remember when the father of one of my friends brought two bags of paper. Was Xeroxed, but that time the Xerox machines didn't exist. We had ERA, Soviet copying machine, which was almost impossible to reach, but those who could reach it. So this ERA machine was used to copy on pages the novel by Orwell, 1984, and we were given like 36 hours to read it, three of us. The way we were reading it, we spent a lot of time passing the pages to each other. And helping each other with our stumbling English and stuff. But even then, without the internet, we were doing it. And I remember how one of our friends somehow learned about it, and he just was trying to persuade us to, you know, allow him to be with us. And the funny thing is, it turned out that his cousin was a KGB officer. And the KGB officer learned about that. And he was begging us to give him this thing to read without telling anyone. So I'm giving you the example,
right,
how it was at that time, because especially in 70s, even KGB officers were understanding the absurdism of the situation. And, it was not like in 50s or 60s already. And there was a system. The whole society didn't like police, militia. They didn't like KGB, but KGB officers themselves didn't like the idea that they already serving them there. Not everyone, but many of them. And the whole system was in a huge I mean, crisis. And it looks like with the digital era today, this crisis is going to be even quicker and faster. Mm. I just pressed the button today to find out how many results will be in Google with Putin Huilov, for instance. In quarter a second, there were like 664,000 results.
Right.
You know, and well, actually, this law is also about that. I mean, if Pussy Riot in this Orthodox Church was saying something else, but not about Putin, I doubt that they will be sent for 2 years in jail or something like that.
Simple hooliganism, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's only because they were singing about Putin. And those laws, when these laws are signed almost simultaneously, again, it comes to my mind, this is also, in a way, about Putin. So what I want to say, the situation in the Soviet Union was completely different. Today, these laws simply will not work. Even, let's say, if Navalny retweets it, anything, or Nemtsov retweets anything, or somebody in a remote Siberian village retweets something, you know, if he has an access to internet. There's two different things. The law will be selective for sure if they want to crack down or control internet. And the other thing is, if you have a smartphone in St. Petersburg or Moscow or elsewhere, you don't need to log in. Any time you retweeted or did something like that, you can say, well, I left it with my friends. I left my phone with my friends. We were drunk, and I don't know who retweeted. I mean, this is the whole right. thing is impossible
but,
to...
But as Mark, as you pointed out, what this is all about is encouraging self-censorship, right? Now, the yeah. Internet's been this bastion of a free expression, even while the rest of the media has come under tighter state control.
I agree.
And this is where I think the real effect is going to be, because if people are thinking twice before they, and let's face it, I mean, those of us in the media now that work with social media, we live and die on retweets and likes. When this podcast goes out, I'm going to measure a portion of its success by how many likes it gets on Facebook and how many retweets it gets on Twitter. And if people are suddenly inside of Russia afraid to retweet and like things, it's kind of a rating system. It does have this dampening effect, no? Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, very much so. Again, as I said, this is about sort of, in some ways, the theater of repression. I mean, speaking of theater, I mean, for example, precisely there, they present one of the justifications for the, you know, cracking down on obscene language as being exactly that it contributes to moral degeneration and violence and so forth. Now, let's be blunt. We haven't really seen the crowds of violent theater hooligans brawling in the streets over the respective merits of Chekhov versus Gogol. But the point is, it's, you know, it's a relatively safe sort of place that you can actually censor. And it flags up. This is no longer acceptable action. So too with this whole business of retweets and so forth. I mean, actually, it's much harder to be discreet in the modern age. I mean, it's all very well you saying that you didn't know where your smartphone was, but the point is, it's easy for the state to actually track exactly where the smartphone was when it retweeted something. You know, every time you walk through a Moscow metro entry, your smartphone is being logged in terms of locations. I mean, there's all kinds of ways in which actually modern technology can provide ways for the state to control its people. Usually the constraint is, though, that you have far, far too much data and far too few people to actually monitor it. And this is what I mean, going back to this point, that it, on the one hand, it's to allow them to target specific people. Precisely, if Navalny retweets something that can be interpreted as, you know, supportive of extremism or whatever, bang, they can say that's worth another 3 months on your suspended sentence or whatever else.
5 years.
Well, yeah. But likewise, for most people, it's not actually as if their phones are being listened to or their emails are being read or now their Twitter feed is being monitored, but it'll precisely have this chilling impact. Make people think twice. And in this respect, I kind of agree and disagree with Mirkat in saying, on the one hand, absolutely, in the modern age, it's so much harder to control all the different ways that people communicate and the sheer speed of it. But on the other hand, people are still people. And if people can think that Big Brother is looking over their shoulder all the time, then ironically, you don't need Big Brother to be looking over their shoulder all the time, because most people are not heroes, and therefore people will adapt. I think that's the idea. The problem is, though, and it's the last point I want to make, is that this is all about perception and belief. This will work if people, ironically enough, believe that it'll work. If people really think that the state is going to be able to monitor them, then that's fine. It'll have that chilling impact. However, Russians do, as you pointed out, have this extraordinary genius for subversion. They always have, and they will continue to demonstrate it now. They will find ways around it. I mean, I will never now walk past a Yolky Palky restaurant and look at it in the same light. I haven't heard that clip. But exactly. I mean, they will find new euphemisms. And then what's the state going to do? Have to issue another list of phrases that you can't use? You know, people will find their ways around this so that they can still communicate what they want to communicate without making themselves vulnerable. And in the process, they undermine the fear of the state. In the process, they make the state look much, much less formidable and much, much more stupid. And that actually contributes to the decay of the power of the state. So in this respect, I mean, I think it's one of these measures that at first it looks very ominous. One can hear the Imperial March from Star Wars blaring over its internal speakers. But actually, precisely, we start soon moving into comic operetta territory.
Well, yeah, one of the things that came to mind when I was looking at this was, if you remember a couple of years back, in Belarus, in order to get around the ban on public demonstrations, people were just, having their cell phones beep at a certain time in the park, mm-hmm. or just clapping simultaneously. And it led the state to make a series of laws that became increasingly absurd to stop this, mm-hmm. and you're wondering if we might be going into that territory in Russia.
Well, in Russia also was like toy demonstrators.
Yeah, they were bringing toys out to demonstrate.
And that's actually a tactic that one often finds. I mean, if you look at CANVAS, Center for Applied Nonviolent Strategies, essentially it came out of the Serbian movement against Milosevic that now trains peaceful anti-government protesters and demonstrators around the world. One of their tactics is precisely engineer situations that will force the state to look silly. and that in this respect, I mean, the Kremlin is essentially ahead of the game, making unforced errors and looking silly without anyone trying to put in that situation. But yeah, wherever it is, even if it's just simply the spontaneous walks that we saw in Russia. We all just happen to be. This is not a march. This is not a protest. We all just happen to be walking down the street at the same time. People will find ways around this.
Right. Now, my question to you, Mark, also same as I asked America: where or what is the digital equivalent of the Soviet kitchen now? What is the digital equivalent of Samizdat now?
Well, I mean, it's where it was a week ago and a year ago. I mean, a lot of it is precisely, it is online, it is in Kontakte, it is in Twitter, and so forth. But it's precisely that people just simply adapt how and what they say to the new rules. I don't think people need to try and migrate. I don't think that we're going to see some expansion of the dark net or whatever as people try to get away from the censors. It's so much easier just to find ways round the existing laws. Let's face it. I mean, if we go back to the business of the banned words, well, there are still many, many unbanned words. you can use some of them, or precisely use euphemisms.
Yeah.
Just wanted to add during the Soviet time, not only dissidents, but all the different parts of society were creating their own languages. I remember those Fartsovshiki, for instance, who were under supervision of OBHSS and KGB, those who were selling jeans and some Western items. They had their own language, which was created very in a smart way. For instance, не хотите ли вайтовые трузера с файновым лейблом на левом покете? And everybody understood that, or this kind of stuff. It's not only language those who are criminals and stuff, but also every society had their own language. Those who were listening to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, when some interesting or Voice of America, they always called each other and said, "Well, послушай воздух." Listen means to the that air. Something interesting. But you know what is that? You nobody understood how you're gonna. But there were different kind of ways how to express that. And I also want to add, this law I read very thoroughly about the recently signed laws. It says that the extremism, the words or phrases which are considered to be extremist. This law says that they have to be added to the list of extremist words in 30 days after they are found as such, meaning that there is no list yet, or if there is, it means that
there is no list. Actually, are we talking about the law on extremism or the law on profanity?
Extremism.
Okay, no, on profanity, there's no list yet. Yeah, that I know.
So the thing is that. They just opened the door here. Anyone can be persecuted if his or her words are found extremist, but
post factum.
Post factum, yeah, and added later. So this is a very interesting law in terms of this, as we mentioned here, of self censorship.
No, and in terms of the profanity law, there is not a list of banned words yet, which I found, which reminded me of one of my favorite comedy routines from my adolescence, the immortal George Carlin, rest his soul. 7 words you can't say in American television. There are 7 that you can't say on broadcast on cable. You can say anything you want these days, but those in the 70s, there were 7. I'm not going to say them, but there, you know, there's what 400,000 at that time. There's 400,000 words in the English language, and 7 you couldn't say on television, as Carlin pointed out. What a ratio! I'm sure there's going to be more than 7 words that are going to be forbidden in the Russian language. But yeah, this does open up the door to all sorts of creativity. And again, Belarus comes to mind. I'm reminded of a sign I saw at an anti-government demonstration in Belarus that said Mukaludak.
Yeah.
And, it's doesn't take too much creativity to
yeah, there
to
will
see
be
that.
More and more like this. But again, I want to reiterate, if in the Soviet Union it took decades to reach the point when even officials or even some KGB officers or police officials started to understand that the system is rotting and started share anecdotes and even to ask to get some samizdat thing, you know, because it was interesting for them as well. In the era of internet, it's going to be much faster.
Right. Well, this is what I wanted to kind of go at right now is, I mean, the Kremlin was getting creamed online up until recently, right? They looked inept, and the opposition was running rings around them. And we had podcasts about this. I even coined a term, the power horizontal. Right, that was going to supposedly counter the power vertical because the Kremlin just wasn't that good at this game. Mark, what do you think? Are they catching up now, or is this again desperation, like you suggested earlier?
Well, it's hard to see how this counts as catching up.
Or have they found the anecdote? I guess to it, or the prophylactic, or what's the word I'm looking for?
Well, let me put it this way. I mean. Anyway, there's two issues. I mean, on the one hand, is this going to dramatically change the nature of the information space? And the answer is, I think it'll have an effect. But again, the effect will be disproportionately towards the people who probably weren't questioning the Kremlin line anyway. There's a really interesting article by Kevin Rothrock in Russia magazine at the moment, and he's looking at propaganda, and he raises the point of this Levada survey that looks at online usage, and that the overwhelming majority of people get their news from the big news aggregator sites like Yandex. Now, that's the kind of, as it were, the mainstream stuff. That is, for want of a better word or better expression, it is the online equivalent of Russian TV. It's where, on the whole, the message is largely going to be shaped by how the Kremlin wants to control it. And it's only a piddling little 4% who actually go for the little critical, independent analytic sites like Newsroom and Vyedomosti and such like. Now, the point is, for the people who anyway were probably already relatively comfortable with the kind of pap that they were being fed on Pervy Kanal and such like, well, then fine, this will probably also speak to their concerns and help slightly shape their message. But anyway, they're already in the bag. For the people who are already critical, who are already suspicious of the mainstream line, well, for them, this will just be further proof of the fact that precisely the Kremlin is trying to censor and control the information space, and they'll find ways around it. So anyway, I what I don't see is this is necessarily changing.
Uh-huh. That's interesting.
Okay. I think it just, as it were, entrenches existing views. But the second point I'd make is that, again, we come to the point of how does the state manage to avoid looking ridiculous? And although at the moment, you know, we'll have to wait and see how and when this actually gets applied. It might be one of these laws that just sits on the statute books and almost never actually gets applied. But if it does get applied, I mean, again, we'll have to see how well the state manages that. Because I think the danger is that if it does try to use it as a tool, it runs the risk of looking terribly inept. If it's just some person who happened to, you know, click like on a post that someone else then decides is in fact extremist, it will look like a ridiculously heavy-handed move by the state. And if nothing else, we'll just continue to speak to this narrative of a state that is both vicious but also clumsy and inept. Mm. So, I mean, I think actually this, in many ways, I think there are dangers for the state more than opportunities.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, I wanted to talk about dangers and opportunities as well along the lines of the ban on cursing in film and film, the media, and theater. Mark, you correctly pointed out this is on one hand, it's an attempt to kind of show that Russia is a bastion of traditional values. But it's also a very useful tool to shut down anything they may not like, be it film, theater, or media outlets, because, again, the list isn't even, we don't even know what words are on the list yet. But doesn't it run the risk of making the state look, for lack of a better term, incredibly prissy? I mean, Russians love to curse. We've made that point over and over and over again, and they're really good at it. No less Sergei Mikhailov, the director, who's very pro-Kremlin, pointed out today, this is one of the greatest contributions of the Russian language to world culture. As somebody that got to listen to this and then was taught about it during my time there, I have to agree. I mean, I've never seen a people that curse more creatively. Isn't this going to make the state look prissy and make and nanny-ish and turn off a lot of people? America, whoever wants to jump in here.
Well, back to the Soviet time, we were watching movies and saw One Life, and after we were living in cinema theaters, we were watching and living in a completely different life. So abandoning natural words from movies, it means abandoning the real life on the screen. And that's exactly is going to be very artificial. It's going to sound very artificial for anyone who attends that, and it was going to be not so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that too much cursing, too many bad words in one movie is bad. But you know, even
have rating systems for that in the West. You know, I mean, minors are forbidden to go to a movie
in the West it's different. Content. Well, if you just take there were like hundreds of and still are hundreds of ethnic groups in Russia today, including smaller ones, but they all speak their own language. But when they curse, they speak they curse in Russian because nothing can compare with the. With the Russian expressions, they are so, as Dovlatov once wrote, that there's even some, you know, competitions, you know, how to do it in a more grotesque and, more eloquent way.
Yeah, which writer was it that said the blah, blah, blah and the yo-yo-yo is beep over Russia like the sound of Sputniks?
Yeah, and when I was when I was a soldier in the Soviet Army, we even said that if the curse words are banned, the Soviet Army stops functioning.
Well, I mean, the Soviet Union didn't even do well. There wasn't cursing in film in the Soviet Union.
Or
in theater.
First words openly were shown in movies only after Perestroika.
Mm.
Before that, it was completely forbidden.
Now they didn't go so far as to extend this to music and literature. These have to contain warning labels, because when this thing was first working its way through the Duma, I was like, my God, they're going to have to like ban some of the greats of Russian literature. I mean, Pushkin, for God's sakes. I mean,
yeah, some Pushkin verses with which contain
Dovlatov
contain words. Well, Dovlatov was never published in the Soviet Union,
but it's still a great of Russian literature.
How they're going to use him? No, I don't know.
They just has to have a warning label. Literature has to have a warning label.
But in the Soviet time, in many publications, verses of Yesenin and Pushkin were simply omitted.
Mm.
And Mayakovsky...
Right, Mayakovsky, yeah.
They were not included. And only those who had their books issued long ago, they had them. It was a rarity. Mm. Well, in general, books, especially old books in the Soviet Union, were very, very expensive, and they were very valued.
Mm. Mark, last thoughts from you on whether the state's getting a little too prissy and whether that'll have an effect before we move on to other territory.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, after all, that Putin is sort of the Russian leader who, more than others, has actually popularized the use of certain sort of slang, mat, and such like, which is, as you say, is one of the glories of Russian tradition. I would just want to pick up very briefly on Meerkat's point about the gap between real life and propaganda, which is absolutely crucial. And we saw it with the Soviet Union. You know, it's all very well telling Soviet workers that their counterparts in the streets of Manchester were starving, and therefore they were actually living much better lives. You know, people might not think that sounded wholly credible, but the point is they didn't actually have a personal yardstick by which to measure it. But on the other hand, when you had sort of people being told that, you know, everything's fine with agriculture and you just can't find food in the shops, or there is no war going on in Afghanistan and your cousins come home in a zinc box, that's the point where you suddenly, as it were, have that epiphany, truly realizing how you're being lied to. Well, okay, this is different because this is not about lie. But again, it's anything that opens up that gap between life as it is lived and life as it is in Kremlin world is actually deeply subversive, I would say, to the state.
Uh-huh. Okay. And do you think the state's getting is going to be perceived as being kind of too prissy and nannyish as a result of this, given how much Russians like to curse?
Well, it's ironic that we've seen, in many ways, a central feature of Putin's appeal to the Russian masses has been that he is a sort of a real man, a proper Russian mujik. He's a man of action. He's not afraid to swear, etc., etc. Now, this definitely would seem to be running against that particular threat. It does seem to be much more of a sort of, a nannyish thing. We'll see if it plays out. I mean, it might just simply be a seven-day wonder.
It might be. Okay, well, in a few moments, we'll shift gears and move into Mark's territory, the nexus between crooks and spooks, and look at a case of a group of Russian hackers who are reportedly targeting Western energy firms. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining me in our studio here in Prague is Mirhat Sharapjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFRL's Central Newsroom. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Dragonfly appears to be focused more on espionage versus sabotage. Semantic first began investigating Dragonfly in early 2014. And with evidence, Semantic has uncovered indications that the Dragonfly group has been in operation since 2011.
That was Jonathan Omonsky, Director of Security Response Operations for the U.S. computer security company Semantic, speaking this week. A new report this week by Semantic claims that a hacker group from Russia known as Dragonfly has engaged in systematic attacks against energy companies in the United States, Spain, France, Italy, Germany, Turkey, and Poland. In the June 30 report, Semantic alleged that the group inserted so-called Trojans into software used by oil and energy firms to allow employees to remotely access industrial control systems. More than 250 firms were affected. Mark, you are, as I noted, our crooks and spooks specialist. What caught your eye about this?
I think, again, I'm constantly working in threes today. I think, again, 3 points, I'd say. One is that it emphasized that we have a very, very strong hacker culture still existing in Russia. And it's one that's historical. I mean, it goes back really 20, 30 years in some ways, and has been generationally renewing itself. But the second point is that there is a growing phenomenon of the so-called patriotic hacker, who is not necessarily a state employee, but nonetheless has relationships with the state, or just simply is wanting to support the interests of the state. And these are the sort of people who we saw acting as many of, shall we say, the cyber war cannon fodder against Estonia in 07, Georgia in 08, and so forth. But this particular case, I would say, looks much more like actually something that has been managed by the state or some state or parastate entity. Firstly, precisely the fact that the operation, it was not just simply to just cause mayhem. It was not to put some vainglorious sort of image up on their web page or whatever. It was to plant these Trojans, which were essentially tools for information, i.e. intelligence gathering. And let's face it, the energy market is one of the key battlegrounds for Russia's struggle for global power these days. And it was interesting, I mean, the fascinating little sort of tidbit from the Semantic report, I mean, it noted that the overwhelming majority of the cyber attacks take place what, on Moscow time, is between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. Mondays to Fridays. Very much, this does not sound like teenagers in, you know,
so
in
business
their back
hours
bedroom or whatever. It's punched in business hours as of, well, certainly at least the UTC plus 4, you know, Moscow right. time zone. And again, I mean, I think what this really emphasizes is the extent to which, you know, we do operate in a new world in which two things are the case. One is that all the various tensions and struggles of the espionage world are found umpteen times more actively in the cyber world. Right. And secondly, that the Russians are amongst the countries that are being the most aggressive and most forward in using these technologies.
Yeah, the New York Times quoted Kevin Haley of Semantic as saying the apparent motive was to learn more about the energy company's operations, strategic plans, technology. But he added that the potential for sabotage was there, although that wasn't the main goal at this point. Now, this is coming at a time when, let's face it, in the wake of the Ukraine crisis, there is attempts on the West, in the West, and there have been for some time, but they've gotten ramped up lately to change the energy game. There's talks of building those LNG terminals in Lithuania and Poland to ship liquefied natural gas from the United States to the European market, which would not only cut into Gazprom's profit margins, but would cut into, let's face it, Russia's geopolitical strength, because the two things are directly related. It comes at a time when shale gas is threatening to change the equation. And it's coming at a time when Western energy firms are getting much more serious about renewables. And clean energy, someplace where Russia is nowhere. Do you think, is this related to that, do you think, Mark?
Yeah, it's all part and a parcel. I mean, we have to realize the extent to which the hydrocarbon sector in Russia, even when it is notionally purely or primarily in the private sector, is all really part of the government's apparatus. And it can become, you know, entirely that at any point when the Kremlin wants. So in this respect, economic espionage for corporate gain and political economic espionage for state gain really are one and the same thing. And so absolutely, I think at the moment Russia is very concerned about wanting to know exactly what's going on in terms of the global energy market. This is, as I said, one of the covert front lines in the current struggle between Russia and the West. But I'd also add that just because these particular operations did not lend themselves to sabotage or to, you know, more intrusive forms of espionage, it doesn't preclude that they were just simply the initial stages. I mean, the same way as intelligence is always applied before you actually launch a military attack, well, so too, actually getting a sense of the systems architecture, getting a sense of the software strengths and weaknesses of these various corporations could well be useful information if a little bit further down the line you want to do something a little bit more pressurizing.
Do you think Russia would do something, as you put it, pressurizing without the plausible deniability? Because now with this, we would kind of know where this comes from, right?
Well, the point is this, we have a pretty good sense. I mean, I love the fact that it's the hacking group, sometimes it's known as Dragonfly, but otherwise it's Energetic Bear, which I think is really quite charming, and not entirely subtle. But the point is, you would gather the information this way, and then if you then wanted to segue on to something more dramatic, then presumably that attack would be done in ways that are a little bit more deniable. But to be honest, I mean, the whole problem with the sort of the cyber theater is actually proving attribution is very difficult. You know, if we look at Estonia in 07, if we look at Georgia in 08, on the one hand, sort of looking at it in a technical basis, it's almost impossible to prove precisely where those attacks originated. Even though, looking at it from a big picture, geopolitical sense, we have absolutely no doubt where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is classic Russia. Again, it may well be that this tactic will not work in the future, but in the past, Russia has been able to do things that everyone knows what it's doing, but because they can't prove it, because in terms of the rules of the international game are such that they can't act on that basis.
Yeah. No, when I was at NATO headquarters last week, one of the things that almost everybody was saying is one of the things NATO has to get better at is defending in this regard. Mm-hmm. But what came up again and again and again is it is very hard to detect exactly where an attack originated. So I guess, I mean, is detection as important as defense in this regard?
It is as important, except that, first of all, it's just very hard to do. But secondly, only if you're then going to do something about it. I mean, actually being able to say that we have pinpointed it, it comes from this FSB hacking station near Voronezh, there we go, we know it, is all very well. But then what do you do with that information?
Right, right. My last question on this is, again, similar to the question I put in the first half, is, I mean, it seems obvious to anybody that's looking at the macro trends here that Russia is going to lose this energy game in the long run. They have an energy advantage right now, but that energy advantage is fleeting. And that energy advantage, let's face it economically, is the only economic advantage they have. But once LNG comes online, once shale comes online, and once renewables get really going, Russia's going to have a big, big, big problem. Are things like this, again, a sign of weakness?
Yes, because Russia is in the long term weak for the reasons that you spell out. I think what things like this reflect is, first of all, a bid just at least try and decelerate the process. The deluge may come, but at least it'll come on someone else's watch. Mm. And this is the same kind of short termism we've seen in so many other ways. If you think of the massive reserves that were accumulated during the good years, and instead of spending those on infrastructure, on genuine economic diversification or whatever, they ended up just being sat on, frittered away, trying to keep the ruble propped up when the financial slowdown came, and spent on the military, on vanity projects, mega projects and such like. You know, all this is terribly short-termist. So likewise, I think, you know, in this situation, frankly, it's hard to know quite what Russia, as currently constituted, could do. It can't completely re-engineer its economy, not least because part of what doing that would involve would be changing the legal system. The political system, exactly. I mean, you know, we currently see the arbitrage courts being increasingly turned into toothless things, and they were one of the few success stories that actually had at least a chance of preserving individual property rights within Russia. So, I mean, unless you're going to do that, completely re-engineer the country, you just have to accept that you're in a slide. But on the other hand, you can try and dig your heels in and slow that slide down as much as you can.
Mirka, last word to you before we wrap up.
Yeah, just one of the interesting examples of what's happening in Russia regarding hacking and other things. I just recently found several of my classmates, again, thanks to the internet and odnoklassniki.ru. They're living in different countries. Many of them live in Russia, and some of them turned out work for oblast administrations in different parts of Russia and other places. And I was surprised when I asked them to send me messages from their workplace. They said, we are not allowed to have internet in oblast administration or city administration because of possible hacking. And I said, who on earth is going to hack small place, a small tiny city or town in Russian Siberia. The administration, no, this is a regulation across the country. Uh-huh. So then I said, well, this sounds a little bit paranoid to me too. I mean, it also shows how Russia is very active in hacking things, trying to control what's happening abroad. Doing that, they're afraid that somebody
is going to be hacking
them back. So this is what my friends, my former classmates, my friends for many years told me. Uh-huh. And it looks like it's true because they are employees of these places.
Okay, on that note, we will wrap up. That's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining me in the studio here in Prague has been Mirhat Sherabzhan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFRL's Central Newsroom. Thank you, gentlemen, for the fascinating discussion.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Happy Independence Day to all you Americans out there. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.